My name is Professor Fulton, and this is Managing Workforce Diversity. And I think of all the different classes you can take here at SPIA, this hopefully will be a fun one and very practical, and one that's, you know, you have the hard skills, like the quantitative classes, and I describe this as the soft skills course. And really, this is one that I see everyone is going to have to engage in. Whether you're working for a private sector organization, public sector organization, nonprofit organization, or if you're just living in your community and engaged in community activities, diversity is a social reality. There's no way to avoid it, and society is becoming increasingly diverse. And so from my perspective, this is like a great soft skill. If you can take the things from this course and incorporate them into your own life and into your own leadership styles, it's something that will help you to be successful, will help your organizations be successful, will help your communities to be successful. A little bit of my background, I spent 15 years in the nonprofit sector working with university students and communities, connecting college students with their surrounding communities. And part of my experience was at Stanford University. And if anyone knows sort of West Coast Stanford, right adjacent to Stanford University is East Palo Alto, which is a very low-income, low-SES community. And so you think of combining Stanford students and bringing them into a very different culture from their whereabouts on campus was one of the experiences that I had. And then after that, I lived in Compton, California, South Central LA, and worked at Compton Community College and a couple other colleges in South Central area. And I think through some of those experiences, what I became aware of, because I grew up in the Midwest, and I grew up in a place that was very culturally homogeneous. And so by then, immersing myself in places that were very different from me gave me an opportunity to see, okay, there are social differences, that my way of viewing the world, my way of making decisions or approaching problems aren't just the normal way for everyone else. And so my hope, and the things that I've learned then, is when I'm in these organizations or in these groups and I have a diverse group of people, I can't just sort of just go with the status quo of this is how you run an organization or this is how you run a group, but I need to step back and sort of begin to understand what are the cultural and social dynamics within this organization. And my educational background, I'm an engineer as an undergraduate degree, but then I got my PhD in sociology. And so my hope is that I can combine some of the hard skills of engineering, the analytical rigor that comes with engineering, but then translate it into the soft skills that you might find in sociology and in the social sciences. And so in my research that I do right now is directly related to this. Basically, I study community coalitions around the country, and I look at how those coalitions become more diverse. And then also, how do they manage their diversity? How do they, once they're like a very diverse group, how do they manage that diversity? And then finally, how do they leverage that diversity to advance the goals of the organization? And so the stuff that I look at is coalitions that are embedded within communities that are looking to address the social needs of their broader community. And if you've listened to the news, you will realize, okay, this is a hot topic. You know, whether it be Google, who is doing a diversity audit and saying, we're not a very diverse organization, or if you look at Ferguson, Missouri, you'll see that there's are all the issues related to race relations within communities that people are struggling to figure out how to manage diversity. And so if you can come to an organization and say, I kind of have some insights on this, I have some background, I've actually studied this and looked at this, you will be an asset to your organization, because most people are scrambling to try and figure out how to crack this diversity code. Not only how to become diverse, but then also how to manage that diversity, and really ultimately how to use that diversity to make the organization better. So what I want to start with is just a quick, we'll go around the room, and you can give me your name, your hometown, and your major. And say it loudly so everyone can hear it.
I'm Zach. I'm a management major, and I'm from Fishers.
I'm Steven. I'm a senior doing management, and I'm from Long Grove, Illinois, just outside Chicago.
I'm David, I'm a management major. I'm from Naperville, Illinois.
I'm Luke, I'm a HR major, and I'm from St. John, Indiana. It's like a suburb of Chicago.
I'm Ewan, I'm from England, and I'm a management major.
I'm Kayla, I'm a human resource management major, and I'm from here, Indiana.
I'm Luke, I'm from New Palestine, Indiana, and I'm a management major.
We'll start up with Nick.
I'm Nick, I'm a management major, and I'm actually from Louisville.
I'm Sam, I'm a management major, and I'm from Fort Wayne.
I'm Tucker, I'm a management major, and I'm from Indy.
My name is Cole, I'm a management major, and I'm from Jasper, Indiana.
Great. Yeah, so I hear the word, so a lot of management, and a lot of HR, human resource management majors, and even with this course, Managing Workforce Diversity, I have slight issue with the naming of the course. One with managing workforce diversity, in that managing is good, but I would see it as leading. You know, managing connotes this idea of micromanaging and sort of how can we control and sort of reduce issues or problems or mitigate problems. In reality, if you want to be effective in the world of, in a diverse world, it's being a leader in that. And so every time I hear the word management, I think of like office or sort of the top-down management type of thing. And really, my desire and my hope in this course is to create leaders who can lead through diversity, lead in the midst of diversity. And so a lot of the focus is equipping you to be leaders within a diverse workforce, leaders within a diverse community. And then also the word workforce I have some issue with because it's too limiting. If you just think about your organization that you're employed by and think of that as just the scope of this course, that is too narrow because in every sector of your life that you'll be going into after this, or even actually right here now at IU, is going to be a diverse environment. So it's whatever student group that you're involved with, whatever community-based thing that you want to participate in. If you eventually have children and they're in school, it's a diverse school that your kids are in. Or if you go to church or go to some faith community, there's going to be diversity there. And so the idea, all these concepts apply beyond just the workforce. In any type of community or organization that you're a part of, these things will apply. And the thing is, especially if you're of the majority culture, reality is you don't have to really care. If, you know, me as a white male, I don't have to care about diversity. To some extent, I could just continue living life as is, and I'd be pretty fine. And so it is a choice, especially people of the majority culture, to say, do I want to engage social differences? Because for a long time, the majority culture hasn't had to address that. And they just sort of continue to be sort of, this is the way it is, and we're going to move forward as if we are in control and that everyone will sort of adapt to our majority culture. But I would say that there's drawbacks to that, several drawbacks, not just social and political drawbacks, but even potentially profit-making drawbacks to sort of having one majority culture sort of driving the force of your leadership. And then finally with diversity, you know, it's interesting. When I talk to people about the word diversity, the first thing that comes to their mind is race. And not only just race, but they think black and white. And so diversity has been reduced down to this very narrow thing of black-white relations. But in reality, there's several dimensions to diversity. And it'll be a challenge. It's a challenge for me, and it'll be a challenge for you, that when we talk about diversity, to think of it in the most broad terms as you can. Think about multiple dimensions of diversity and how an organization or a group of people could be highly diverse. And there's a journalist out at UC Berkeley who studies diversity, but what he studies is biodiversity. And his whole thing is about biodiversity within agriculture. And when I came across his research, you know, at first I was thinking, why am I studying someone who's studying biology, and how in the world would that have anything to do with managing workforce diversity? But what I found is that his research if you sort of step back and look at a broad view of what is diversity and what are its implications, I actually saw a lot of parallels to diversity in the natural world and the implications of diversity in the natural world compared to diversity within the social world. And here's a quick clip on his perspective on abundance of diversity within the natural world, or also a lack of diversity and the implications of that.
Monoculture is in a way the only thing you need to understand about the way we grow food industrially in this country. In one sense, monocultures are very simple, and in another sense, they're very complex. They're simple in that they represent a simplification of the landscape. You know, every species eliminated but one. They're complex in the sense that they need such a superstructure to hold them up. They need pesticides, they need machinery, they need fertilizer, they need pharmaceuticals in the case of animals. Farmers using monoculture need to buy a lot of things. They need to buy pesticides. Pests love monocultures. I mean, there's so much food that its population explodes. And so monocultures are very vulnerable to disease. The other vulnerability is that they exhaust the soil. Every plant is taking the same things from the soil and not putting things back. Although it's consistent with the logic of industry, make lots of widgets, same size, from one machine, it contradicts the logic of the natural world. You don't find monocultures in nature. Nature just doesn't work that way. Nature doesn't put all her eggs in one basket. It does have a certain power. And undeniably a power. But whenever you have the logic of industry on the one hand and the logic of nature on the other, the logic of nature eventually wins. It's these huge monocultures in American agriculture and world agriculture are making bees' lives very difficult and creating conditions where they're vulnerable to disease and exposed to pesticides. So, my take on colony collapse is it is one of the signs, the really unmistakable signs, that our food system is unsustainable. It's destroying the conditions upon which it depends. It has internal contradictions that will lead to breakdown. And we've never known where that breakdown will occur, but it may well be the loss of the bees. We know the solution. The solution is not to expose bees to these vast monocultures.
So for me, what I found intriguing by this is that, or the hope is that it sort of causes you to sort of step out of your narrow way of thinking about diversity and then looking into the social world and natural world of the implications of monocultures or diverse cultures. And, you know, some of the things that Michael Pollan said in this was that monocultures are susceptible to disease. And if you think about that and translate it into the social context, that homogeneous groups on whatever dimension are susceptible to disease or dysfunction. Like there's something inherently going to be problematic within these monoculture or homogeneous groups. And the other thing they said, that there's this need of such a superstructure to hold them up. And if we think about the social world, there are social structures that are put in place to sustain homogeneity or like-minded thinking. But it takes a lot of energy to sort of keep those structures in place, and those structures also inhibit the thriving of other cultures. You know, if the structure's in place to sort of support the majority culture, then it inhibits the thriving of the alternative cultures that are there. And so what I want to hear just from some of you is think of your groups that you interact with here on campus, and I want you to identify the group that is one of the most homogeneous. When you think about it, I'm very encouraged that this class represents some good diversity. This will actually help the discussions and interactions. But think about a group or a place that you live or any type of activity that you're involved with on campus that you would sort of characterize as being highly homogeneous. So, and don't just think racial diversity, but think gender diversity, think academic discipline diversity. And so what are some groups that you're involved with that you would say, that's fairly homogeneous?
I don't know if this counts, but so I play like a lot of intramural basketball.
Uh-huh.
And there's not a lot of girls out there.
Okay.
And
yeah,
so
yeah.
It's mostly guys.
So it's gender homogeneous, male dominated. Okay.
I was just trying to think about my workplace. Like, it's like 80% men, and then like 75% are in grad school, and then like 50% are like music majors. It's really weird, just kind of like how it all falls into place.
And where do you work?
I work for one of the bus services.
Okay.
Here, and so like, kind of like you have to be of a certain age to like get the license, like that makes it all grad students. But it's weird that we're all like music majors.
Half
of them are music majors.
Because music majors are good bus drivers, right?
I guess it's just how it works out. I don't know.
Yeah. What other groups or things are you involved with that you would just say, it's a pretty homogeneous group? Emily.
It's like what he said, I work in a tanning salon, and literally every person is a white female. And I'm homogeneous.
What about in the back?
I worked at Oliver Winery at the vineyard.
Just
like running a farm pretty much. And
yeah.
We had two women out of eight of us, so it was just like we were all men. Another thing about that was kind of interesting was like we got trained on like pesticides and herbicides.
Yeah.
And the videos were, like, when we watched the videos, all the workers were, like, migrant workers.
Interesting.
It was kind of interesting, like, to notice that, like, there's no white people in the videos.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, at Oliver Winery, are you working in the field amongst the grapes? And so what is the predominant ethnicity of the workers? Yeah.
I'm currently working on food pantry project here at IU.
Uh-huh.
And most of the people that I work with are like old white ladies.
Old white ladies. That's very good. That's a good example.
For me, it's hard to think of places without diversity because no one has walked the same footsteps. So even in this classroom, if everyone looked the same, they haven't walked the same steps. So like, there's diversity no matter where you look.
Uh-huh. And what's that like? So keep elaborating on that.
So even in maybe my recreational sports job where it's mostly white males from Indiana,
mm-hmm.
if you look at it from that general of a scope, it's kind of lacking the idea that everyone has, they're not living in the same house when they grow up. And
mm-hmm.
maybe some people are going through struggles that you don't know about and they've been brought up different ways with different parents. So there's just like diversity everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a very good point in that you could have a group that sort of looks very, very homogeneous, but as what Zach is saying is that the life experiences might be very different or their current situations that they're coming out of. And I would argue, though, that as the group along different dimensions becomes more diverse, the diversity of life experiences within the room in the wider the variation increases. So you're right, even if a group is sort of all white males, there's still a lot of difference in the room. But then if you begin to change up the ages of the people, some of them now have kids, some of them have grandkids, and so then their life experiences, the diversity and variation within that increases dramatically. And so the idea then is, especially if, you know, when you're in Bloomington, there's a certain level of diversity, but then if you go to Chicago, that just amps up, and then how do you manage the growth of it? Because there's a term in sociology called homophily. Does anyone know what no one's even heard of homophily, probably. I didn't know what it was. But it's a very powerful social reality in that the idea is that, it's a very simple idea, is that people who are similar to each other tend to gravitate towards each other. And so even if you're in a very diverse environment, like in Chicago, people who are similar to each other will just gravitate towards each other. And so in Chicago, you have a lot of these ethnic-specific communities where they become high concentrations of similar people. And so, you know, you might have a desire to become more diverse as an organization, or you want your group to become more diverse, but there's this powerful social force called homophily, which is we don't even really control, But then you just sort of see that groups gravitate towards similar people. And you see this even in who you choose as your marriage partner. They're going to be very similar to you on most of your demographic characteristics. Or if you look at student groups, you'll see that similar people gravitate towards each other. Or even, you know, what was interesting for me, when I was working in East Palo Alto, I attended an African-American church. I wanted to be, like, progressive and sort of be involved in a predominantly African-American church. And it was about a 300-person church, and it was about 30 white people. And I was involved with that church for 4 years. And as you know, I felt sort of like, okay, this is good. I'm learning about other cultures and learning about different ways of worship practices and engaging the surrounding community. But when I looked back on the experience and I was looking at who I actually hung out with, what was interesting is the people that I was friends with in that church were the other white people. But I also had a few friends who were black, but when I looked at it, they were of African descent. So it was like a friend from Nigeria, a friend from Ghana, and a friend from Ethiopia. And so in a strange way, homophily, even though I was immersing myself in a culture that was very different from me, homophily was still at work, where my friend network was mainly the other white people, and then the people of African descent, where the education level of these people, the reason why they were in East Palo Alto was because they were grad students at Stanford. And so then there was sort of similarity on education level and similarity on different backgrounds. So, you know, even if you have a highly diverse organization, there's social forces that are going to take place where you tend to gravitate towards like-minded people. And the implications of that is, say I was the leader of that organization, and I was thinking to ask people to step up into positions of leadership. The people that we tend to ask to partner with or to lead with us is our friends. And so if I was a leader within this organization and I was saying, okay, who else can I ask to join me in helping out with stuff? I'm going to turn to my friends and I'm going to turn to the white people and the African people. And then all of a sudden the power structures within that organization get shifted such that it's all of my friends and people who are like me who are running the organization. And so even you can have the best intentions of wanting a very diverse organization, very diverse team, but there's these social forces and social structures that are in place that sort of undermine a lot of your best intentions. And part of it is just simply being aware of it. And so for me, it was becoming aware. I was just like, this is very interesting. I'm a part of a predominantly African-American church, and yet the people that I'm closest to are very similar to me. And so even the whole aspiration of being a part of a diverse community wasn't really being fully lived out. So as we enter into this course, I want you guys to pull out a piece of paper. I'm going to ask you to write down, why are you taking this course? And what do you hope to get out of it? So just jot down a few notes of why are you taking this course, and what do you hope to get out of it? Okay, now I want you to pair up and share what you wrote with the person. So get in groups of two. You guys can do three there. So just find another person and share, just sort of share what you wrote. Okay, how about some of the people share with the whole group why you're taking the course and what you hope to get out of it? I think I heard a good one by Nick.
Oh, basically, I just think that diversity issues are interesting. I think it's just looking at the underlying facts of why things are the way they are, and then why it's okay to talk about it sometimes, but then some other times it's not necessarily that okay to talk about, mm-hmm. just why that is. And
yeah.
So
yeah.
It just kind of interests me. So.
Sam.
The company I want to work for, they have 13,000 employees, and they actually have a required diversity class that every employee has to take within like 3 months of getting their job. And I want to do communications and HR, so I think it's really important to be able to try to be on the same level as some people, because they have so many like different income brackets within that organization, and that just sets so many people apart,
mm-hmm.
anyways. And then when you add on gender and race and sexual orientation and stuff like that, it mm-hmm. becomes really...
Which organization is it?
It's Norton Healthcare in Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay. Have they already said, we want to give you a job, Sam?
We're working on it. We're working on the last 2 summers, so it's been
okay. Oh, that's good. And then you can come in and say, well, I've already taken the class,
yeah.
So... That's good. Other people? Steven?
I worked at a really diverse place this summer, a huge organization, and I just want to gain competent skills on diversity and just learning all sorts of forms.
Uh-huh.
Not just the traditional, like what you were saying, but from the video, like other forms that I'm not aware of.
Yeah, yeah. Which organization was it?
I was at GE Healthcare.
Okay. Where, based where?
They're based in Milwaukee. I was in their Barrington, Illinois office.
Okay.
It's close to my house.
Okay.
It's just a traveling thing.
Great. How do you pronounce your name?
Ewan.
Ewan.
Yeah.
Okay.
I also worked at a really diverse organization called Cummins in Columbus, Indiana this past summer. And from working there, I really saw that there's a lot of really kind of different people. It's a really diverse workforce. And just seeing like the different perspectives that were brought up and how everyone managed like different tasks was really interesting to see.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm like just really interested in like all that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, that's very good. Which organization was it?
Cummins.
Oh, Cummins, okay. What about back here?
I think at some point in my career I'd like to be in a management or leadership position, and in another respect on my own company at some point.
Uh-huh. Yeah. No, that's great. You know, I mean, it's like you guys will be at an incredible advantage having taken this course, because most people lack competency, lack a cultural competency of sort of how to engage differences. I mean, everyone is just scrambling to sort of figure out how to do this. Like, you think police units are thinking about, okay, what's the demographics of our police force in reflection to the surrounding community? Or you see, like, when you're talking about food pantry, they need volunteers, but it's all older white women, but the constituents that they're serving is a much broader population, or even the resources that older white women might have access to is very limited compared to if they had a much more diverse base of volunteers and leaders, they could have access to a wider variety of resources. And to me, it's an ongoing learning process, and my hope in this class is that we can learn from each other in a sense, because there's continually more and more things that we learn about differences within people. But the only way to learn about it is by hearing from people's personal experiences and drawing from that. So what I want to do, just to have a better sense of where we're all coming from, and I want you to line yourself up based on, let's see, the question is, okay, how diverse is your hometown that you came from compared to IU? So compared to the diversity of IU. So if your hometown is like uber, uber diverse compared to IU's level of diversity, then I want you to stand, like this is the 10. I want you to stand up here. If your hometown is sort of just as diverse as IU, you kind of stand right here in the middle, like a 5. And if your hometown is even more homogeneous than Bloomington and IU will say, stand here. So if you're coming from a place that's just super, super homogeneous, come down towards this end and stand down here. So get up and go where you would fit yourself.
Yeah,
okay, and we'll sort of spread it out a little bit, so then to pull, like don't move your place in line, but we'll just do it so you can pull over here. I mean, you're not representing, so we'll say basically no one's like super more diverse than IU. So let's go for people down at this end. Someone share about your hometown and why you see it as being much more homogeneous than IU. And say your name as you share.
I'm Luke. I'm from New Palestine, Indiana. It's a small town, like 3 minutes east of Indianapolis, and it's just predominantly white. There's probably one African American that I graduated with.
Uh-huh.
Out of like 270 people.
Uh-huh.
So I figured it's predominantly white.
How big is the town?
Roughly? I'm not really sure. I mean, I think there's only like 2,000 residents in the town, and then all the outskirts of like, people still going to school.
Okay, wow. Great. Someone else from the more homogeneous communities.
I'm Emily. I'm from Brownstown, Indiana, so it's like an hour south of here, but it's like not close to anything, like no cities. And it's like basically kind of like a really rural area, so it's very homogeneous because everyone just kind of stays there and they don't really move away. So I think that's kind of the main issue. And it's very small.
So someone in the middle range.
I'm from Columbus, and like he said, he worked at Cummins, where like their headquarters is. So because of them, they have like they drive the workforce there. So they have a lot of people coming from all over to work there, and it's actually like changed the way the city. There's a lot of culture in the city now.
Uh huh. And then on this end, we'll have to go with you because you're coming from.
I went to Pike High School. It's on the northwest side of Indy. When I graduated, there was 54 different countries represented in the high school. I was a part of like the 10% white, and then a heavy, heavy majority of just others. So it was pretty diverse. And you have from trust fund babies to people who are on food stamps in the same class.
Uh-huh.
And it's very different.
Yeah. So what's your experience then coming to IU?
I mean, it was good culturally for me because I feel like I can get along with just about anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean,
yeah,
is always where I wanted to go, so it didn't really go.
And someone else on the higher end.
Well, actually, being from Bloomington, I feel like I'm kind of belong more.
Yeah,
people, but,
yeah, that's right.
but it is different outside of campus than it is on campus. It's a lot way more diverse on campus, but outside it's still pretty diverse. But
mm-hmm.
there's definitely still some Southern Indiana vibes
mm-hmm.
going. So,
Okay. Well, that's good. I mean, part of that will help us to get a sense of where we're coming from in our experiences. You guys can go back to your seat. Does anyone not have a name card made? Everyone has a name card. Here's some statistics. And it's basically the demographics, the racial demographics of IU. Anyone guess what the 81% is? So we have 81% white. But then these are kind of interesting. They're actually all fairly similar, but any guesses of what the next most represented racial group on campus? And what's interesting, 3.9% identify as being mixed race, but of those 3.9% that identify as being mixed race, over 95% are white and something else, versus like Latino and African American or Asian and African American. It's white and. I don't know exactly what that means, but I just found that very interesting that 95% of the people that are of a mixed race are white and something else. And then these statistics are for the state of Indiana. So in the state of Indiana, 81% are white, 6.4% are Latino, 1.9% are Asian, and 9.5% are African American. And a lot of times, when people talk about diversity, sort of the default in terms of like with racial diversity is, oh, well, if we want to have, you know, if we want to achieve diversity, let's have it be 25% white, 25% black, 25% Asian, 25% Latino. And that's sort of one way of thinking about diversity, like let's just make it as diverse as possible. But another way of thinking about diversity is representativeness. So when you think about your organization and you're assessing the level of diversity, rather than sort of have the bar be equal representation across the organization, another way of thinking about it would be how representative is your organization of its surrounding community. So if you're a school and you're looking at the teachers, and how diverse is our collection of teachers, it might not necessarily be necessary to aspire to equal proportions of every racial group. What you could do is look at your student population and what students are being taught in your school and what students are in the surrounding community, and sort of aspiring to have your teachers be representative of the students being taught. And that's not just racially, but then even gender. You know, if you look at elementary schools, there's a way over representation of female teachers compared to male teachers. And in some ways, this can free up an organization to think, okay, like, how are we going to get 25% of our teachers to be Asian American when in the entire state of Indiana, only 1.9% of the people are Asian? But you could look at it from a different lens and say, well, gosh, what proportion of our students are Asian American, and what proportion of our teachers are Asian American? And think about it through that lens, especially in a place like Indiana where you might have just less diversity to begin with, it'll sort of free you up to think about it in a different lens of thinking about it in terms of representativeness versus just strict sort of proportions and even proportions across the board. So then with this course, as I alluded to, the way that we're going to look at it, and it's going to be sort of framed throughout, is in three focuses. And the first is the idea of how do you as an organization achieve diversity? So like the first step is becoming diverse. Like how do you help an organization or group become diverse? And then the next step would be the managing diversity, sort of how do you help an organization negotiate differences or navigate the differences that emerge as a result of being diverse. So you have achieving diversity, managing diversity. And with managing diversity, some of the things that come up is the differences that you would find would be in terms of communication, like different styles of communication. One of the things that when I was in California, we had a large Asian American population, and I'd be leading group exercises and group discussions and brainstorming. And one of the things that I experienced and realized was that amongst the Asian American leaders, I would very rarely get direct input on ideas and their thoughts on, you know, what we should do as an organization. And for my culture, it was sort of like, hey, speak up if you have something to say and even disagree with me in that moment. But what I learned was that because a lot of the Asian American leaders were not speaking up, we as an organization were missing out on what they could contribute to this brainstorming or problem-solving process. And so for me, it was a matter of recognizing differences in communication styles. And so I was like, okay, I know that they have something valuable to contribute, but there's something about my leadership and my style of leading problem-solving or brainstorming that was inhibiting them from sharing. And so I was thinking through, part of it was just simply asking them, like, outside of the meeting, of saying, hey, listen, I'm curious, like, I noticed that you were kind of quiet during the meeting, and you know, I'd like to better understand why that was the case. And what I found over time was, a lot of it was just like, well, you know, you're the leader, and I don't want to be disrespectful, or I don't want to have the wrong answer, or I don't want to contradict what someone else is saying. And so there's a lot of just sort of inhibitions, but it's rooted in this idea of wanting to show respect and wanting to submit to the authority. And I was like, oh my goodness, no, you can disrespect me all the time. You can speak up and disagree, but it just, that was like not their approach to communicating. So a part of what we would do was just, before we began the discussion, we'd have people just write down what their ideas were, what their disagreements were. And then that allowed them, it provided a communication style that was more accessible to them, that allowed us to draw out the ideas from them. Rather than just sort of having, this is the way we communicate as an organization, it was begin to think, how can we diversify our communication styles? Another thing was issues related to power that come up when you have social differences. So if you have class differences, there's certain leadership characteristics that are developed. You know, that the higher socioeconomic status you have, there's certain leadership characteristics that you're sort of trained and developed in, that the higher class person would naturally take charge and lead a situation. And yet, what happens in that is that the people that are of lower socioeconomic status don't get developed as leaders and they get overlooked. And so if you think about the power dynamics within an organization, and if I'm trying to lead and develop leaders, it isn't just sort of saying, well, who are the natural leaders and the ones who just sort of step up? They are natural leaders, but they've been conditioned and developed based on their class status. And so it's identifying ways of helping to empower lower class people who might not have had the training and the skills of like public speaking or even debate or engaging in critical problem solving, of thinking of ways of, okay, how do you develop them in their leadership skills so that they're equal contributors to the organization? Because otherwise, you could have a very class diverse organization, but it's still led by the higher SES people. And the lower class people, their voice and their contribution is minimized. And so a lot of what the managing of diversity is involved in sort of how do you identify these things like communication styles, power differences. Some of the other things is how you resolve conflict, and then also identifying what are some of the dominant cultures or the dominant norms that are present in the organization, and the other ways of doing things just sort of get pressed out. The idea is how do you then recognize, okay, there's different ways of doing things, there's different ways of approaching problem solving, and begin to incorporate those into your leadership style. And so we have achieving diversity, how do you help your organization become more diverse, managing diversity, like once you have a room full of diverse people, there's going to be more conflict, there's going to be more differences, how do you manage that? And then the third one, which often sort of tends to get overlooked because you just stop at, well, how do we manage this? How do we keep from splintering up into multiple factions? The third would be leveraging diversity. And to me, this is the most interesting and hopefully the most compelling, in the sense of it sort of would answer the question of why become diverse? You know, if it's not going to advance the goals of the organization or help advance the objectives we want to accomplish, why even become diverse? Because that's an open question. You could talk to a fraternity and say, you know, and someone comes in and say, hey, we need to become more diverse. But there's going to be a lot of people who are going to say, why? I kind of like it the way it is. Or whatever organization you're leading, even, I'll say, the food pantry with the old white ladies, they're kind of like, well, no, this is like our social club, and we kind of like it the way it is. And so a part of it is, how can becoming more diverse actually enhance the organization and advance the goals and objectives of the organization? And if you're in the private sector, it's, will this help us make more money? You know, is it going to increase our bottom line? And it's an open question. Of all the research that's been done, a third say that increasing diversity leads to greater profits, and then a third say that increasing diversity leads to lower profits, and then the remaining third says that increasing diversity has no effect. And so it's a very open question. You have people debating back and forth of whether or not increasing diversity will actually help the bottom line of the organization. But if you're working for an organization where the return on investment isn't the only bottom line, that there's multiple bottom lines of empowering leaders or educating students or having broadest impact within the community, then there's greater potential for diversity having an impact, a positive impact on your organization. And so almost making a case for why increasing diversity could actually advance and enhance the goals of the organization. There's this multinational organization called EMC Squared. It's a high-tech company, multinational company, and it's similar in the sense of like Google or Facebook or any of the other like Silicon Valley type organizations, where they're wanting to become more diverse, but they're having a hard time becoming diverse. And this video, we'll watch it and you can give me your thoughts on it. But it's basically a marketing strategy of theirs to why diversity is important.
from here. I studied in different countries. I encountered different cultures. I always thought that the ability to adapt to change was a strength. I felt the need to push myself to new challenges and grow within
years. With the EMC, life's choices make us all different. At the EMC, I work with many outstanding people. I've understood that by putting different personalities on the same project, we usually get the results that go way beyond the simple sum of everyone's individual work.
As a millionaire, my team empowers me to manage strategic accounts for the company. I'm aware of the responsibilities my managers have entrusted me with, and I am proud to contribute to
EMC success. Here, I found a company and a team that share my passion for new technology and innovation. I can see the difference we make in serving your customers by working together every day.
Mother means to be able to manage two worlds without ignoring one or the other. I'm able to conserve my family life and my professional life. At EMC, flexibility is a key factor in our business relationships.
Thanks to my origins, I contribute to the rich culture of the company. I learn from my colleagues and they learn from me. And I know that EMC gives me the opportunity to grow.
The human component has always been essential in my career, and I found that here, an open-minded team that knows that we are greater than the sum of our parts, regardless of our background, by working together.
I have seen the company progress from its roots to become market leader. My greatest pleasure is sharing these experiences with my team to help the next generation of employees.
Thanks to our experiences and differences, we shape EMC values. And thanks to our individualities and our skills, we ensure our team excellence.
Business is fully diverse. Society is diverse. Our customers are diverse. Talent globally is fully diverse. EMC is a diverse company. We want the most talented people in the entire industry to come build their career with us here at EMC, to share the benefits of their knowledge with our customer base.
Find this fascinating. Like, this is a recruiting marketing video to bring in the best employees. And I think a part of it is when someone comes into an organization or is interviewing to work for an organization or is thinking about volunteering for an organization, they have to be able to say, do I see myself in this organization? In knowing what I want to do and become, do I see people similar to me? And could I fit in here? Could I be valued and could my voice be heard? And I think that's what they're trying to demonstrate in this video. Is like, we want the best and the brightest. And in order to achieve that, we need to make ourselves available and accessible to all types and not sort of be narrow in our hiring practices and even narrow in our policies that show preference to certain groups or certain people. And so a lot of what we'll be talking in this course is how do you leverage diversity to enhance the goals of the organization, and how can you help diversity, the differences within the organization, make the organization better. I'm going to pass out the syllabus. So on the first page, in terms of where I can go quickly with office hours, basically I'll have office hours right after this class from 11 to 1. And my office is up in SPIA 419, which is basically the top corner of the building, top northwest corner of the building. But if that block of time doesn't work for you and you still want to meet, just email me and we can set up a time that works. And in terms of the course objectives, the way that I kind of see it is, one is becoming aware of social realities or social facts, like what is the facts in terms of demographics of different dimensions of diversity in the U.S. and in Indiana or beyond. And then also, what are social science theories of how different groups interact and relate to each other, how social structures shape those interactions. And then also, part of this would be an awareness of yourself and your own biases or your own background and experiences and what you bring to the table. We'll also talk about policy-related things, legal issues related to diversity. So it's going to cover sort of a breadth of social science and management approaches to this topic. And a way to tease it out, if you look at page 2, and this is probably the most critical one as far as what you're going to bring to the class, I think it's 10% of your grade is just class participation, and that's showing up to class, having read the material for the day. And a part of that is the next step down of the analytic memos. And so each week you're going to have a chapter that you're going to be reading. And before you come to class for that Tuesday, I want you to write an analytic memo. And an analytic memo is not just a summary of the chapter, but it's more sort of your critical response to what was there. And so some of the things is explain a particular part that was interesting, meaningful, or eye-opening. Sort of use the chapter as a springboard to here's my reaction to what we read, or here's what I disagreed with, or here's what was really resonated with my experience, or here's what was confusing. You know, some sort of what I don't want and what you won't get good grades for is if you just summarize, because I can summarize. But what you can give to me and to the rest of your classmates is your personal response to the chapter. And it's short, it's just one page, 300 words, and if you give me more than a page, it won't count. So keep it to basically one page, roughly 300 words, of just your own analytical, critical response to the chapter. And also important in that is including one question. You know, after you read the chapter, have at least one question that you write down about the chapter that I don't get this, or, you know, this seems to be different from what my understanding is. Why is that the case? And just sort of have that at the bottom. And you can actually ask multiple questions if you want for that. So that would be basically due every Monday at 10 p.m. And who isn't on Canvas or knows Canvas? Okay, you don't know Canvas. That's fine. I'm learning Canvas too, so... Do you need help getting onto Canvas? You'll figure it out. And basically, all the assignments are submitted through Canvas. So, you know, you write your one page in as a Word doc and then upload it by 10 p.m. on Monday. And then the next assignment, which will be every week as well, is a personal reflection. And what I want this to be is more your own personal reflection on what went on in class. The previous class session. And again, it's not summarizing, okay, we talked about this and then this and then this, but more take one thing that stood out to you, something that was meaningful, something that was confusing, something that you appreciated, something that you disagreed with, and just give a personal, this was my experience of what went on in class. And this is even shorter. It just is a half page, 150 words. So the purpose of these assignments is not to be onerous, but it's more just sort of a quick snapshot of like what's going on for you in this course. And so it's not intended to be, I'm not going to be necessarily grading on eloquence or articulation or even writing styles, but more just give me your experience of the course and what stood out, and also a question that comes to mind in response to what went on in class. And again, you upload that to Canvas and submit it to me. And so each of those will be worth 10% of your grade. And it's a pretty simple grading process. If you meet the length, content, and formatting requirements, you're going to get full credit. You're not being graded on the type of thing that you write, but more so just make sure it fits within the content requirements. And if you do it only halfway, like you don't meet all of the requirements, but you hand something in, you'll get half credit. And if you don't do it, then you'll get zero. So, you know, these aren't going to be detailed grade things, but I'm going to be using them to enhance the quality of the course and to just sort of get a sense of what you guys are comprehending and taking in. And then the next, if you flip over so there'll be two exams during the course of the semester, which will be multiple choice and short answer, and then a final exam. Each of them will be worth 15% of your grade. And then the big cumulative project for this course, it's under the title of Diversity Audit Project, And this is going to be a group project. There's going to be four people per group. And the way this is going to be done, and I base this off of what Google has done. Google, about a year and a half ago, came out and they did a diversity audit. And you know, like a tax audit is when they go in and look at all your books and sort of say, what's the state of the organization? And is what's on paper reflected in reality? And so a diversity audit is basically going into an organization and assessing the level of diversity within the organization, both on how well are they achieving diversity and managing diversity and leveraging diversity. And so in your groups, you will identify an organization, whether it be an IU student organization or an organization in Bloomington that's large enough to reflect somewhat substantial, or to have the potential to reflect diversity. And basically you're going to do, in a sense, a semester-long project on this organization and walk away with an assessment of how well are they doing at achieving diversity, what are the things that are holding them back from achieving diversity, and then also with the level of diversity that they have, how well are they doing at managing it, what are the things that they're doing to manage it. So you're going to be almost like a consultant going into this organization and first gathering information about it and then making assessments and recommendations for the organization and then begin to even build a case for why they might want to become more diverse and how becoming more diverse would help enhance the organization and improve its ability to accomplish its objectives. And so that will be done throughout the semester in your groups, and it'll culminate in a presentation where basically you'll be presenting to us and we're sort of like the board of directors, and you're sort of saying, you hired me to be a consultant for these past 3 months and here's my findings and here's my recommendations. So that will be the presentation, and then you'll give a formal report. Basically, again, it's a report that you'd be giving to the board of directors of your assessment and recommendations. The report is only about 5 pages long, so again, we're not looking for extensive writing, but it's more, you know, people are busy and they want you to cut to the chase and say, okay, here's what's going on. And so you can put in graphics or visuals to help that, but it's basically you're going to be presenting a formal report to the board of directors. So that's the diversity audit project, and I'll talk about more about that in future class sessions. The next page just gives you a rundown of what we'll be doing week by week. And then this is the book that we're using, Diversity in Organizations. Does anyone not have this yet? Great. You'll be able to get it, though? Okay. So, because you will need to read the first chapter by Thursday. And by this Wednesday at 10 p.m., you'll need to submit a personal reflection. So the first personal reflection on what went on in this course today. So you're writing a personal reflection on what went on in this course today. Yes?
So you only write it for Tuesday classes?
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea is that writing one analytic memo based on the chapter, you don't have to do a memo for chapter one just because of the timing of the course, but then basically you'll then write the personal reflection for what went on Tuesday's class. Any other questions related to the syllabus? Great. I think we're all done. And then just leave your cards at the desk and I'll pick those up. And that'll be the way that I can sort of see who came and didn't come each day.